Hello and welcome to episode 7 of The Brass Cast. I am your host Zoe Wright and today I am joined by tenor horn virtuoso Owen Farr. Owen began his musical career with the Pontypool Brass Band at the age of 6. He soon joined the Gwent County Youth Brass Band and the National Youth Brass Band of Wales, progressing to the principal horn in both ensembles. In 1995, he became the British Open Junior Solo Champion and was appointed solo horn for the Tredegar Town Band at the age of 16. He began his studies at the Royal Northern College of Music in 1998, and 6 months later, he joined the famous Williams Fairy Band. Owen thrived in both of these environments and was voted Player of the Year by his fellow players at the Fairy Band. He enjoyed many successful performances with the band and was also a key member in their two national finals victories. In 2004, Owen joined the Corey Band on solo horn, a position which he held for 11 years. During his time with the Corey Band, he won all major brass band contests, all of which he won multiple times. Owen currently tutors at the RNCM and the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, as well as making regular trips to Japan, America and across Europe to teach. Owen is also a clinician and tester for the Bessin and played a key part in the development of the Bessin Prestige tenor horn. Currently, Owen is also the solo horn player for the brass band of Battle Creek in America. And at this point, Owen, I'd like to say thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's a real pleasure to be able to interview you after you being my teacher for the last 4 years.
That's very kind. Thank you very much for the cup of tea as well.
You're very welcome. I'm so excited. This is the first podcast that I've actually been able to do in person. So it's a great side of COVID becoming a little less awful.
Sign of better things to come, isn't it?
Exactly. And if that's all right, we'll just go straight into it, if that's okay. Yeah. So could you tell us how and when you started playing?
How and when? Well, when I was 6 years old. I think when I was 5, there was some leaflets that came through the front door, through the letterbox, from Pontypool Brass Band that were in existence then. They don't exist anymore, which is quite sad, but they were starting up a beginner's band and some leaflets had come through the door, but they wouldn't take children under the age of 6. So my older brother started, and then a year later I could start, so I went down with my older brother and we started there. So I had my first little cornet from Pontypool Brass Band, took some lessons there with a lovely lady called Lisa Parry, who was the bumper up player in the band, and shortly after, maybe a few months, I started taking preparatory lessons at the school then, and that's how it started. And maybe about 6 months later, I started on tenor horn.
Yeah,
I think
made the correct transition onto the tenor horn.
Early promotion.
So, who were your kind of influences as a young player?
Oh wow! Influences, they're great, aren't they? There's so many. I think early on, one of the first I can remember was a neighbour of mine called Will Sandals, who was a tenor horn player that played with the National Youth Band in his day. He was the solo horn player in Pontypool Big Band. That's the senior band.
All right,
not jazz band.
I was thinking that you meant a jazz band.
On jazz tea horn. No, definitely not. So there was the senior band, the junior band, and the beginner's band. So I saw the senior band as the big band. He was their solo horn player, and he was absolutely, absolutely fantastic. And he was a neighbour, so very, very early on, he became an important part of my life and helped nurture me along the way. And eventually I got to sit next to him in the big band, in the senior band. So that was great. Another horn player would have been Paul Holland, who's Flowers conductor now. Paul's a few years older than me. I'd like to remind him every time I meet him. He's a lot older than me. He was the solo horn player, the principal horn player with the Gwent Youth Band and the National Youth Band of Wales that you just mentioned. And so I'd come through the ranks under him, so to speak, and heard him play. And he was a magnificent player. So as tenor horn players, those two were springing to mind in my earliest stages, I think, yeah.
What about going into your teen years?
Well, Ian Porter's become a huge part of that. So when I joined Tredegar, I don't know, maybe 6 months or maybe a year later, I can't remember, Ian moved down to Wales He was then courting his now wife, Leanne. They moved down and our relationship began, and Ian started to teach me privately. And shortly after, he took a teaching post with the Gwent Music Service, of which I was sort of with. And so he became my teacher then. Up until that point, Alan Williams had been my teacher from the age of six right away through, and Alan was absolutely incredible and a big inspiration. But when Ian became my teacher, that was a different sort of perspective, and Ian was the first one to teach me more of the correct techniques in brass playing and correct breathing and all different aspects that are involved in that. So he was great, and that lasted for a few years until I moved up here then up to Manchester.
Yeah, brilliant. So as I mentioned in your introduction there, you were the British Open junior solo champion before being appointed solo horn tradiga. So could you kind of tell us a bit any more about your journey from being a beginner to through your studies to RNCM, why you entered the solo championships, who inspired you or encouraged you to enter solo contest as a younger player?
Well, sort of coming through the ranks, like I mentioned with Pontypool Band, first of all, I was lucky to have the setup where I came through a beginner's band, and then you get into the junior band, but on second horn, and then you work your way up. So it was a stepwise progression, and after that, I got the second horn in the senior band, and then I'm sitting next to Will, and eventually when Will finished, I became solo horn. So it was a stepwise progression, like a filter system that I think was stepping stones that was terrific. So that really helped my young development of always having goals to sort of head towards.
Yeah.
And other people of my era, maybe older, would remember this. There were so many solo competitions and quartet competitions back then in those days, which we don't see anymore. So, I mean, hats off to Phones and others that do it, because it's really, really disappeared. But when I was young, I can remember going along with some players from Pontypool. In fact, Will was one of them that took me to these little solo contests and quartet contests, and as a child you don't know much about them until you get there, and it's just the experience. And I used to love all that. It was terrific. I wish we could see more of that today. But anyway, in between Pontypool Band and Tradiga Band, I played for BTM Band in Bedwas for a short time. And when I joined them, I joined them on second horn. The solo horn player was Di Cornelius, who was also my predecessor at the Corey Band. He was a fantastic horn player. And when I joined BTM, Di also took me under his wing and helped me with so many things. And there was a conductor at Pontypool Band called John Evans, who was a corner player with BTM. And John played a massive part in my childhood development, really. He was really inspirational. He introduced me to Di, and then Di and several other players at BTM, Jeff and Mark Hutchison and Chris Thomas, trombone, they all used to go to the British Open solo contest every year. And if I'm honest, I didn't know anything about it. I was completely oblivious. And they just said, oh, you should jump in the car with us and come up. And it just happened as blasé as that. I got a solo together and just went up and played. I had no idea what I was going in for, really. Maybe it was a good thing, I suppose. I just went and played, and lucky it all worked out.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So you decided to move up from Wales to Manchester to study at the RNCM. So how did you kind of grasp having this time at university, completing your degree, to really develop as a player and indulge yourself into everything tenor horn?
Well, as we all know, as you might know, as a student, the timetable isn't that full. So if other studies, other universities, the timetable is a lot busier. But when you do a music degree at a conservatoire, there are intentionally big spaces there for the student to practice. So practicing is part of your studies. It's important. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky to have all that time to practice. I'd always been a keen practicer. I'd always been interested, especially from my lessons with Ian Porteous on how to develop as a player. And so when I came here, as you'll know, during that time as well, I met Sandy Smith and heard a real tenor horn player. and realised how inferior I was. So I threw myself into practice that way. So yes, I was inspired and motivated by hearing this great player. So it was never a problem for me to find time to practice. And I became fortunate a little bit later on that I lived near Fairy's band room, mm-hmm. which isn't that far from here,
No.
So I had the luxury of either coming to college to practice, or any time after midnight if I wanted, I could go into Fairy's band room and practice there as well. So yeah. I utilised both those things and made an awful lot of mistakes along the way. But yeah, that's part of learning, that you learn mm-hmm. from your mistakes, I guess. But
yeah,
I did an awful lot of practice. I did too much practice, I know, back then, but I was very keen to improve. So that was quite a journey.
Yeah. So as you have been for me during my 4 years at university, you have been my principal tutor. And uh-huh. during your time here, you had Sandy Smith as your principal tutor. What was it like having Sandy as a teacher?
Wow, this is something we could talk about all day. I think amazing is the answer to that. But I remember the first time I met Sandy, or I remember the first note I heard from Sandy. Going back a few years, back to when I was young, there was no YouTube and Spotify and things like that then. Mm. So you only had a CD recording to go by, that was it. And I had Sovereign Soloists that Sandy featured on, and I had Double Champions that he featured on with Fairy's band as well. Mm. So I'd heard him play. But something about digital recording and live playing was completely different. So when I was playing with the Gwent Youth Band again, Sandy was the soloist who'd come down. So, and this is only about a year tops before I came as a student at Manchester. So he came in and played, and the first note he played was a middle G. It sticks in my mind.
I love that you can remember that.
Yeah, I remember it. And I wasn't playing in the band I sat in the band. I wasn't playing my part. I was just watching and listening. And he picked this horn and played this first note. And I just don't know what happened to me. I don't know what hit me. I just thought, wow, so that's how it should sound. That's not how I sound. That is just... And I remember looking at his instrument and his mouthpiece, thinking, what has he got that I don't have? Mm-hmm. And it was nothing. He just had a simple Sovereign and a Dennis Wick mouthpiece, same as everybody else.
Yeah.
But just played like I've never, ever heard. Quickly, I realised that was for me. I mean, that's what I need to study about. So I was so excited before coming here. And I stayed in touch with Sandy prior to coming here a little bit. And then we started. And I just always asked him to play. Always. I was asking him to play. And luckily then, 6 months later, as you said, I joined the band mm-hmm. and played first horn next to him. So I had him then purring in my ear.
Yeah.
Which is quite intimidating, but inspirational at the same time as well.
Yeah.
So I was lucky to hear him play all the time in band, and then to come here and take lessons with him as well, which was just absolutely terrific. And then when we come to college, I ask him about in band, how do you do this and how do you do that? And he was the most incredible player, even putting the fact that he's a tenor horn player to one side, as a player, he was just so incredible. And his sound, like I said, that first note that I heard is what strikes you. But once you get into it, there's a lot more to his playing than just the sound. How he attacks the notes, how he releases the notes. He can change his sound like a chameleon. He can spin his vibratos in different ways. And I just couldn't wait for every lesson just to sort of say, oh, pick you one up and just show me that. he was great. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Well, you kind of... In the middle of answering my question there, beat me to my next one, which is absolutely fine, do not worry. Which was, I'm going to ask, what was it like, obviously he's your tutor, but obviously sitting next to him at band.
Yeah.
You, obviously, as you said, you spent hours with him a week.
Yeah,
week
yeah.
in, week out, weekends, concerts, contests, everything, you know. And you were spending so much time with him, but that was, which is an incredibly unique situation. I don't know of many other situations where...
Yeah, I was lucky.
Players are in that situation, but did that bring any challenges with it? Because you were spending so much time with him, he was your teacher, but also your colleague at band. Was there any challenges within that, or did you just begin just work together and you just admired him?
I don't think there was any challenge from a relationship point of view. I don't think. I mean, he was always unbelievably professional, and I was always a very keen student. So the chemistry from that point of view were great. I think the disadvantage was what I did to myself back then, being so inspired by him, by practicing so much, trying, you know, aspiring to play like him and be like him, and instead of giving my lips a rest, I just played all day, every day, trying to be like him, and did a lot of damage in my early years doing so. But I was excited, you know. I was young. I was 18, 19, 20, inspired. Well, I'm 42 now. I'm 42 today, aren't I?
Yes, happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I'm still inspired by him. Every time I pick my horn up, you cannot hear still in my head all those sounds that he produced. So, no, the chemistry was great. And if anything, it probably made it a bit easier, because I was sort of his young Padawan at band.
Yeah.
It made things easy for him, and he could see what I was struggling with at band, and coming to college then, he could very gently, delicately deal with those matters, which is very kind of him.
Yeah. That is absolutely fantastic. I love that. So whilst you were at Fairies, whilst you were a part of the two national final championship performances, which is, I guess, kind of your very early success in banding, which we'll obviously dig into a little bit later on. But what was it like for you to be a part of these performances?
Well, I'd been... So 2003 was the first national. So I'd already been in the band almost, you know, sort of 4 or 5 years going into that. And the band had been through quite a lot of changes anyway. So players had come and go, and conductors had come and gone. So we were always working hard in the band room. I think we all knew that things were settling down. And a few new players had joined the band. Morgan on euphonium, Kevin on soprano and things. And we'd all been together a lot longer. So the movement of players had settled down.
Yep.
We were gelling. And I think we knew that good things were happening. I'm not saying I was expecting a victory, because I never had one, but things felt pretty good. And we did Masquerade, which is an incredible hard piece, and Morgan was just jaw-dropping, as he was in every rehearsal. But to go on the Albert Hall stage and do that, it's, you know, expecting something like that. So when we came off stage, thinking, oof, certainly to me, that was, I've never experienced something like that. So I knew somebody would have to do something special to beat it, and that was the winning performance. So that was brilliant. So I wasn't expecting a win, but the journey I'd been on up until the age of 23, whatever, I'd always been up and up and up and up, and that was the best performance I've ever done. So yeah, it was great, and fortunately more followed. But yeah.
Amazing. I'm pretty sure, I think, when in Morgan's interview, he actually talked about that performance of Masquerade being like one of the hardest euphonium parts he's ever played. But
oh, it's a frightening game, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness me. But it was a terrific band then. A huge trombone solo with Nick Hudson playing, and the band were terrific. So yeah, many good memories from that.
Absolutely brilliant. So during your time at Fairies, you were voted Player of the Year by your fellow players and colleagues. How did you feel being awarded this?
Well, that was unexpected. That was something I ever expected. Do you know, in some ways, that almost means more to me than so many other things that I might say I've achieved. Yeah, I don't know how to explain that. That is just magical. I mean, at the time, it's, you know, a band doing awards night and all that kind of stuff, and you start there with all these great players and picking up, I guess you reflect on it when you get home. You think, "Wow, other people think that of me. That's great."
Yeah.
And I think they knew the struggles I'd had before it, and I'd taken over from the horn god himself.
Yeah.
So it was horrible shoes to fill. I had worked so hard, and I'd struggled, and I think they obviously appreciated it, and thought, "Oh, that's brilliant." So a very special feeling that, yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
A moment that you'll hold in you forever.
Cherished. Yeah, absolutely.
Upon completing your degree in Manchester and going back down to Wales, leaving Fairies, you joined the Corey Band.
Mm.
Could you tell us how that opportunity came about?
Yeah, well, Corey Band back then were the Bayes of You
Corey
Band. And Bob Charles had been in touch about the position. And when the time arose that seemed a good time to move down to Wales, me and Bob met up and talked about it, and that was where we went from there, really. Mm. So yeah, Bob had come to me and put it to me, and yeah, that's how it started. So that was 2004, mm-hmm. I think. So that's two. So actually, after graduating from college, mm-hmm. I stayed with Fraser for 2 years. So I lived out. So it wasn't direct from college. I stayed with him for a bit,
mm-hmm.
and then 2 years later, 2004, that's when I decided to move down to Wales and join Corey.
Yeah. Corey Rand.
So it was Bob that picked up the phone, and away we went from there.
Fantastic. So you had an 11-year stint with the Corey Band as their solo horn player, of which you were a part of many successful performances. During this time, you won every major brass band contest. Mm-hmm. Are there any specific performances from this time that you think are particularly memorable or are standout performances? Tough question.
I'm laughing because on a contest one of the ones that springs to mind is the one of the ones we didn't win. I don't know if it's controversial, but I did two area performances that were great. One was festival music when that came out and we came fifth, and another one was harmony music when that was for the area and we came fifth on that, and I really enjoyed those two performances. And we were given pretty rotten results, which was very strange. So I'm laughing because this came to mind first of all. So many victories. I never won Europeans until I went to Corey, and then I did a treble with Corey. So that was amazing. Which I think I can't remember. Was that 2007? I can't remember when it started. But anyway, and then 2009 was the year when we'd had a Grand Slam. We'd won all the contests, I think, in that year. So that was also great. But I think maybe some of the really does spring to mind actually when thinking about this was we did, not a contest, a performance of something called the Gaia Symphony. So John Pickard had written this humongous symphony for brass band,
mm-hmm.
which we premiered at Cheltenham Festival. And I thought that was such a stunning piece of music and mm-hmm. very prestigious performance to be involved in. It was a huge project the band took on and rehearsed really hard for, and yeah, that was just something so different. There's lots of contests that happen all the time, but something like that was so different.
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah,
brilliant. Brilliant. So, as I've said, obviously during this time that you were at the Corey Band, the band was very successful. But obviously during this time, you had the chance to work closely with Dr. Robert Child and Harper, as conductors as well as your colleagues. What do you think made and still makes, because obviously they're still Grand Slam champions of everything, because since COVID no one's done a contest since, so they're still number one at everything.
Absolutely.
But you've been a member of that band for quite a long period. What makes that band so successful and work?
It's just work ethic. I think that, I mean, there's many different things you could look at, but without doubt the most important thing is work ethic, week in, week out.
Mm-hmm.
Not just getting together and committing a few before a contest. Week in, week out, we still today, Corey Band, work very hard every single rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And every player counts, whether you're playing solo horn or second horn,
mm-hmm.
principal corner or third corner, second baritone. Every player is so important, that contributes towards that band sound and inevitably that band performance. So is there a tuba player we can hear next?
There is, yeah.
There's a masquerade going on. So if I go back to when I was playing, say, with Ponty Paul Band,
mm-hmm.
how that would have been, for example, would have been the good players, the principal players, playing their best parts, and as you go further down the seats, passengers is a wrong thing to say, but the principal players tend to do the brunt of the work, whereas at Corey Band, the tutty players are just so fascinating and incredible. Everybody has a role to play, rather than just the principal players carrying everybody.
Yeah,
everybody gets stuck in, and it's week in, week out all the time. It's maintaining. I mean, Corey Band became the best band in the world. I don't know. That's a good question. Actually, it's around about 2000, maybe.
Yeah.
And once you become the best band in the world, there's only one way to go from there.
Yeah.
It's actually hard for them.
Yeah.
But to maintain that level takes discipline week in, week out to maintain that and mm-hmm. keep pushing that. So it's probably not a surprising answer to most of our listeners, really, but mm-hmm. it is so important that you just maintain that week in, week out and just keep pushing, you can always keep improving. Everybody individually, you keep improving. Within sections, you keep improving. Within band, you keep improving. And that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Hard work pays off, as they show.
Absolutely. If you don't work hard, then how can you expect results? If you work hard, then... Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So you left the Corey band now back in 2015, if I'm not wrong.
I don't know what year it was. I don't know. Yes. I know how old. I was 35.
So
it must be about 7 years ago.
About seven years ago. So, well, there we go. About 7 years ago now. Yeah. And you're not committed to a band full time now. But how was your kind of career and your playing in particular now that you're not going to band week in, week out? How has your career and your playing changed and developed from kind of leaving full-time brass banding, if you want to phrase it that way?
Well, from the solo career point of view, it was obviously difficult, in particular the last sort of 4 or 5 years with Corey, when he continued turning down solo work to stay with the band. And it's never going to work for any top section band to have players that come and go all the time. Mm-hmm. So the decision was inevitable. I knew it was coming. I just kept it off. I never wanted to leave Corey because I loved it, and all my friends are there. And so it was really hard. But finally making that decision then meant obviously my diary could be freed up, mm-hmm. and I could start accepting other jobs I was turning down, and things would build from there, which surprisingly didn't take much building. I was fortunate that when I took that leap, some of it was already there available, which was great. So from that point of view, everything was good. From the banding point of view, though, I did join Battle Creek Band in America. I played with the brass band of Battle Creek a few times before, but when I'd finished with Corey Band, then I accepted the position mm-hmm. with the Battle Creek Band. We only get together 2 or 3 times a year over in Michigan anyway. So that meant I still had a little bit of banding experience, mm-hmm. not on the contest platform, obviously, and on a very different level to what Corey was doing, which was a lovely fresh change for me as mm-hmm. well. So that did sort of keep going, but my solo playing was much more easy to develop then with the timetable being completely free, and also the travel time wasn't there as well, which I was traveling quite a lot to get to Corey. So that was freed up as well, which gave me more practice time as well, or at least it was easier to organize my practice time without looking for desperate windows. You've got to practice there, you've got to practice here. I had more opportunities to practice then, which means I was in a better frame of mind to practice, mm-hmm. which meant I could develop other things.
Yeah. Is it something that you miss doing? Like rehearsals week in, week out, the concerts?
Yeah.
Is that something that you miss doing?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Once you're a band, you're always a band. So, yeah, of course I do. Miss going there, miss sitting there and playing and fairies, I miss fairies. You know, mm-hmm. All banding experience, I miss it all a lot. And I think we can all relate to that from the last 12 months, because none of us have it. And so we all know it's likely to be deprived of it. So, I mean, fortunately, I do, you know, get to travel to other bands. And as a soloist with a band, I get the band experience. Mm-hmm. But not so much. The only time I'm really sat in a band and playing like that is when I go to America now. So, I do miss it a lot. Yeah. Of course I do.
Did you get a lot of phone calls once you'd left Corey? Like, can you come dep for us, please? Did you get a phone calls like that a lot?
I think you always get them anyway. I think, really. They were always nice phone calls.
Oh, brilliant. You've become extremely well-known within the brass band world, brass playing, musical world, really, for your technical ability in your playing, which is absolutely second to none. But as well as this, you've become known for your kind of extensive knowledge of brass pedagogy and teaching, which is something you've really opened my eyes up to over the 4 years that you've been my principal tutor. And some of these that spring to mind are the likes of Herbert Clark, Claude Gordon, James Stamp, Sandra Com, Louis Maggio recently even. But how did you come to learn about all these different practices and techniques and kind of what systems work, what systems don't work? How did you come to gain all of this knowledge and different kind of resources?
Well, the journey would have started 1998 when I rose as a student in Manchester. But shortly after that, my plane took a nosedive, really. And the more I practiced, the worse I got. which was a mystery to me because I thought surely by doubling your efforts you'd be rewarded for it, and yet I wasn't. And so I practiced more and more and more until I was doing easily 8 hours practice a day, but in between Fairies band group and practicing at the college. And my playing got worse and worse and worse, and I couldn't work out why, and it got very, very difficult. And in the end, I kind of realised that bad practice, bad for you. That's the main bit of it. But I had bad habits in my playing, and actually by doing more practice, I was just augmenting those bad habits and making them worse. So I did start to, the internet was coming out then, so I started doing a little bit of research. And there was a music shop up the road, which I started working for as well, that sold books. And I did a lot of reading to help. And Alan Bazzuti had come here when I was a student and sort of inspired me with other things, different views on playing. And so I bought Herbert Clark's books and read about those, and Louis Maggio's books. And then there was Schlossberg, James Stamp and Roy Pope, his student, that had written books. And I read them all and started to get a better idea on the physiology of brass playing and get an understanding of really what I was doing wrong as to why all this practice was not just a waste of time, but damaging me. Mm. So give me an idea of being able to go back to square one, learn the basics correctly to build from there. In other words, just continually practicing all the time was no good. And I'd learned that. So I think all the reading of many different players. I decided to study all the great trumpet players and all the methods, what trumpet players, corner players, brass players, and likes of Joe Alessi, study all those and learn from their experience and build it from there to help find out what I was doing wrong, and then to help with the journey and where to go from there. To dissect it correctly would take us all week, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Right now. But I think it all started because really how terrible I was playing. Mm-hmm. And that all happened really because of Sandy.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to play like him so badly, I tried so hard and did it all the wrong way and spent a long time struggling then.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically on the back of all that was how all that started, by studying other methods and trying to find out the correct way to practice, what to practice, when to practice, how to practice, why to practice, studying all that to get out of the dark times and get on the straight and narrow.
And obviously these, as I said, these are all methods that you've taught me over time. And obviously teaching is a big part of what you do. As I said, you teach here at the RNCM, the Royal Welsh. You've taught at Birmingham and you've been guests here, there and everywhere. But how have you learned, kind of how some of these practice methods work for some students and not for all, and how to apply some of these to some players and not to others, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does, because we play by habit as brass players, and by that we have good habits or bad habits. As I found, I was developing bad habits, and so if one of my students has a bad habit in their breathing or in their embouchure or posture, whatever, and I just give them a ton of stuff to go and practice, and they do that for X amount of time, they could actually encourage that bad habit to grow. So everybody is different. I mean, the study of the art of ear movement and things like that can be universal to everybody, will help everybody, but individually people have different problems along the way. Some people might have very, very tight embouchures where they need to be doing exercises to relax the embouchure. Others might have embouchures that are far too relaxed, like cheeks puffing up or something, and they might do other exercises for the reverse effect. So everybody is a little bit different. So it's identifying what their strengths and weaknesses are and what their habits are. And the way I view it really is, rather than focus on what a player is doing wrong all the time, or a student, focus on what they should be learning to overcome those problems. And by learning new habits, they will kind of override the old operating system. Mm-hmm. That will all disappear. Instead of getting hung up on that all the time. So brass playing is a beautiful thing, isn't it? Because everybody is so different.
Yeah.
And I might say to you, Wynton Marsalis is my favourite brass player in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But if every trumpet player played his way, you would want to hear something else.
Yeah.
You would be craving a Hogan Hardenberg or a different... So that's the beautiful thing with brass playing, that we all play different and can play differently, which is a luxury that maybe a pianist doesn't have, because a pianist doesn't have a sound.
Yeah.
They have interpretation and musical creativity, of course, but individuality, like we talked about Sandy Smith, doesn't come into a pianist point of view. So it's the same with brass players, and therefore different habits are created along the way. So my job as a teacher is quickly, with an 18-year-old student when they come in, is to identify that as quick as possible and give them a set of exercises that will give them something to work towards that will help overcome that, learn new habits that will build their playing in a confident way.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever kind of like come across like actually bad habits or issues within students playing that you've like never known how to resolve, or you've had to kind of go away and research something different that you didn't already know about?
No, I don't think so. Nothing springs to mind. I don't think so. No. You have many students that believe the problems they have are unique to them. And a student will often say to themselves, oh, I can't play high notes because naturally I can't play high notes. And it's amazing how, well, it's not amazing, but how students will tell themselves, convince themselves they can't do something because they were born that way. And actually, sometimes it's just lifting up all the barriers that the student will put in front of them to let them know that they can achieve those things. But I don't think I've ever had a student that's... Maybe one of my favourite best teaching... One of my best teaching memories would be I taught a deaf girl at primary school.
Wow.
So, obviously, at different levels of university, but she had severe hearing loss, and I had a... my teacher's tie, a little microphone that's hooked up to her and stuff.
Yeah.
And she was... Maya, her name was, she was refused lessons by the other departments and stuff, and they came to me and said, oh, go on, we'll give brass a go. And the school thought that brass, being the noisier instruments compared to woodwind and strings, would be better. And maybe it was. And she started, and she had a speech therapist with her that would communicate back to me. So that was probably the most challenging one I've had, but the most rewarding at the same time.
That is fantastic.
It was great, and it, about a year, 18 months later, she got a position in London. So she moved school to go down there to a specialist school that had new groundbreaking technology for hearing stuff. And and I believe she moved on to guitar and is still doing music. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, really good.
I didn't even know that it was like possible. I'm not familiar. I don't have hearing loss. Like,
she had said to her speech therapist as well that when while playing, the vibrations of the brass instrument.
Yeah.
Enhance their hearing.
That is amazing.
Which probably
it's making me all goosebumpy.
Yeah, it's. She was only in year five, you know. She was a young girl. But I suppose that would be right. Maybe sat a piano, you wouldn't get as much as that, or playing maybe a violin, you would perhaps, but certainly a brass instrument. We know when you're playing it, you can feel it, and she learned to play a C scale, and she was working towards grade one and things. You know, for someone that was you know profoundly deaf, it was amazing.
That's fantastic. Mm. That really is like, I'm like proper like goosebumpy and I feel like, I won't well up, but I probably could do.
if you met her, you would.
I definitely would. So as you were talking then, you kind of said, obviously when you start with a new student, when they come into their first year at college or whatever, you kind of like analyse their playing and their kind of first few lessons. How do you do that? You don't have to give away all your secrets, of course, but like, how do you observe and kind of analyse that kind of possible even micro issues within performance?
Well, I like Schlossberg's approach. So Schlossberg will ask a student to play three notes, a middle C, down to a G, down to a like, sorry, a lot slower than that. and by listening very, very carefully, obviously I can see what's going on. So you can see posture and things like that, breathing habits straight away. But listening carefully to those three notes, very slowly, you can hear how the student will produce the sound, and then how you sustain through the sound, and what happens to the end of the note. Mm-hmm. And when you arrive on the next note, will the note be pear-shaped? Will the note be flat? By carefully listening to those three notes, you can see how that A moves from note to note. And usually, playing habits go wrong when a player is shutting down between each note, the lips are clamping down, trying to find the note, and then the A... just a split second later comes into the note. From those absolute basics, you can start to understand how a player is playing. Mm-hmm. And the James Stamp method that comes after it is also based on the same thing, and Roy Popper's explanations are all the same, based on ear movement through the lips. So when we're beginners, we are taught to buzz our lips. we play raspberries. The mouthpiece makes the raspberry a bit louder, and then the instrument makes the raspberry even louder again. But of course, as we develop as a player and our sounds open up, things must change. So, mm-hmm. so therefore the centre of the lip, the so-called buzz, is going to relax, which takes an awful lot more air to go through. The problem that will come with the student then is when they're trying too much, too hard to use the lips, and the airflow becomes secondary. That's not at all the cases, but they're the basics that you look from. And you can hear when the sound becomes strained, or if the sound isn't centred, if the sound is flat or sharp, whichever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when they're going downhill, they'll force the notes flat. When they go uphill, they'll force notes sharp. Every student is different and will have different characteristics, and you will have an idea then of what they're doing. And I think I always fall back on my past as well, and yeah. the struggles I've had, that when a student is struggling, I share the pain, I know how it feels, and I can relate back to that and know where to go from there.
Yeah.
Rather than sometimes they will tell themselves they have a unique problem, there's something wrong with them, they have the wrong mouthpiece or whatever, and it's usually down to the basics and the way they are spinning the air through the instrument, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliant. I find it really, like, fascinating, because I'm just like, where do I start? How do I even change my practice? Like, I know so little. I was coming into college and just letting yourself just learn and take everything in and try. I feel like that's something that I've developed. I feel like I was a bit stubborn at times. I was always scared of change in case it went wrong.
But that's fine. And that's natural, isn't it? Obviously, you don't want to make mistakes. You're on the side of caution. And as you know, during your time at college, there were no obvious changes or anything radical anyway, like you might have worried about. But the beautiful thing about brass playing is that uniqueness, isn't it?
Mm.
That we can create so many different sounds and play in so many different ways. But with that, the problem does come with the mystery of how it works. Because I can say to you about the piano, well, there's no real identity to playing a piano and a sound. And you can't change the colour of the sound. You can't produce a vibrato that way.
Mm.
You can't play with huge dynamics like you can on a brass instrument as well. But there's no mystery into how that piano works.
No.
So read on your first lesson. Yeah, exactly.
Little hammer, you press it and there's a sound.
That's it. You get your posture right, you learn your scales, and this is me doing contrary motion. That's it, away from there. It's just, you're not scared about anything at all, are you? When it comes to a brass instrument, you say, well, how do you change pitch? How do you go from a C to a G?
Yeah.
The most simple question, when you really think about it, oh, I don't know. Do we blow more? Do we use our lips? Do we use our tongues? All of a sudden, that's where it becomes complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, with the piano, with the violin, guitar, etc., it's quite clear how the pitch has changed. So it's the beautiful thing about brass playing, but also the slight worrying thing about brass playing as well. That confuses people. And maybe that's where a lot of the mistakes we make along the way come in, that we shy away from learning the correct things and just get on with it. And sometimes, as I found out, me personally, getting on with it is what made a lot of mistakes along the way, unfortunately.
Yeah. Obviously, you've tried and tested, you know how to use all of these different practice methods, which, you know, we've been talking about. Have you ever considered putting your own method together, which includes bits of everything, and putting it into one place? Or
yeah, I have. Yeah. I have. And I think maybe one day I will do that. But really, everything I have to say has already been written.
Yeah.
And I've not done it for fear of trying to sort of get... Not stamping the toes, that's the wrong thing to say, isn't it? But it's already out there.
Yeah.
So maybe I would write something that would help just bring an understanding to that.
Mm.
My biggest fear, my worry is, and this is probably what I will write about, is the platform that social media gives brass playing today.
Yeah.
And so if we go back to 1864 was when Arban wrote his first method. And you mentioned Saint-Jacques, he wrote his method in 1870. They were the first books the old-timers had, if you like.
Yeah.
And then after that, then Herbert Clark wrote his incredible books, and Louis Maggio, and several other wonderful books were written, Ernest Williams and Jules Levy, they wrote great books too. But today, I think we're in a slightly dangerous position where people will use social media to launch products, sell things and articles or whatever via Facebook. Many of these things, I think, are, how do I say politely, a little dangerous.
Yeah.
They are not encouraging the natural way of playing.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you put inside an instrument or outside an instrument will change the response of an instrument, and therefore you're not playing naturally.
Yeah.
So anything that changes the response and resistance of performing on an instrument, I think it'd be quite dangerous. And there's many things. I don't have to mention any products because we see them all the time.
Mm.
And it's become a part of a lifestyle that people will take to social media and look at those and find a quick fix. And we might see a product, oh, go and buy this, and this will help your high tones or your sound or your technique. And we're like, oh, great. And naturally people, oh, well, I can practice less and gain results even faster with this. That's what I'm a bit worried about. And I think over the last 10, 15 years, with my students, I think I have seen a change with that. It's a bit worrying going forward that the wonderful things that have been written by these great authors like Herbert Clark are becoming forgotten because people now will start looking for quick fixes, which becomes products rather than exercises. I'm a firm believer if you're going to be a wonderful brass player, you have to practice correctly on your instrument. You put that mouthpiece in the instrument and you practice it, and you practice correctly, carefully, structured, the right exercises, not for too often, not for too little. It's all planned and organised and systematic, as Claude Gorham would say.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll enhance your, well, not enhance your playing. I think you can do your playing a lot of damage by buying products that promise to do that.
Yeah.
That's probably, if I wrote a book, I think it would be more on how to practice and how to use the wonderful books we have to become interested in yourself as a player and become interested in what... That's something that Roy Pope was a student of James Stamps, who was a student of Max Lossberg's. And Roy Pope wrote in his book, become interested in your problems, but don't judge them. I think it's a wonderful saying that firstly we judge our own problems and then want to look for something to quickly fix it. And that's where the problems come. So maybe that's what I'll write about one day.
Yeah. I think if you wrote a book, it's something I'd invest in from you. So.
That's one thing.
If that's encouraging for you at
I
all.
I saw the copy.
If there was just one of these practice methods that you could say to anyone, like someone said to you, what is the one practice method that I should invest my time in and really study and that will benefit my playing, which method would you suggest?
That's too hard to answer, I think, again, related to the individual. Because when you say method, I think you're implying an approach. A pathway to take.
Yeah.
If I were to say one book, I would say the Arban, the first one we had, because there's so much in there. The Arban doesn't have much to tell you how to practice, what to practice, when to practice. But one book to carry around, there's so much of that in there. Herbert Clark's Setting Up Drills and Technical Studies books, however, have so much more information at the beginning on how it's done. So, that's a great question, isn't it? I think it depends on who it is. I'd have to have a little lesson with them first of all, and then suggest that based on the way they're playing.
Yeah.
Because somebody could be articulating beautifully, but not slurring very well. And then I might say, well, you know, if you're going to get a Walter Smith Lip Flexibility book, for example, that might help.
Mm-hmm.
Your flexibility is the way you go. Which would have been maybe how Dale Steiger's played his cornet with beautiful flexibilities. Somebody might be moving around beautifully, but not articulating very well. And they might adhere towards Jules Levy, for example. So Claude Gorham said, there's two things you cannot do without in life if you're going to be a great brass player. One is good food, and second is Clark's technical studies. That's a lovely thing, isn't it? I can understand. Clark's Technical Studies is the book that brings everything together.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's the most important, but not for everybody.
Yeah.
Because other people might have to be working on different things. So that's a great question that I can't answer. Sorry about that.
That's absolutely fine.
I don't know how to answer
it. I love asking the tough questions.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Changing kind of subjects completely now, you've managed to travel the world as a tenor horn player, professional musician, soloist. And this includes, as you mentioned earlier, being the solo horn player for the brass band Battle Creek in America. What's that experience been like for you? Is banding brass bands in America very different to in the UK?
Wherever you go, there's always differences.
Yeah.
But a few years ago, I was solos with Founding City Brass Band, and they were excellent. Very much along the lines of what we would consider a traditional British brass band. So, yeah, and lots of others. I play many bands in America, so they are developing a lot, as they are in Japan. Mm-hmm. The Battle Creek Band, that is different because it's a band made up of different style players.
Yeah.
Purposely, so in a concert, we give a very, very different concert, where maybe Wycliffe Gordon will be doing a wonderful jazz solo or something. Or this time we've got Joe Alessi, mm-hmm. another trombone player, playing. It's they very much feature different styles in the concert, which is a great challenge for me because I'm purely from a brass band classical background, so to be doing jazz pieces is
testing.
A new testing challenge for me that I love. I love the challenge, but it's nice to learn something new every time. So that's good. But it's great. And with Japan, I think 2007 was the first time I went to Japan, and I've been many, many times since. And since that time, I've seen the brass band world develop so much over there as well. So it's lovely. You know, in the UK, we talk about the doom and gloom of brass bands all the time. And, there's another brass band folded, and... oh, back in the 70s, we had this many bands. And I know those stats are correct. And I know looking forward, we can worry about it. But globally, brass bands have taken off.
Yeah.
So it's not what it used to be here. I know that. But and I'm moaning about quartets. And so when I was young, that's disappeared as well, that we should try and resurrect. But across the globe, that the brass band scene is growing magnificently. Mm. And it's wonderful to see. So that's a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as we've said, you've travelled all over Japan, America, all across Europe. Where have been some of your, like, performance highlights? We obviously mentioned earlier about some of your, like highlights with Corey and, obviously, performances with Fairy. But kind of, as a soloist, where have been your performance highlights?
I don't know. Performing the Strauss Orchestra with the Northern Sinfonia is one that I'll always remember because that was with the full symphony orchestra behind me as a professional symphony orchestra, and that was terrific. That's certainly not something that I do on a daily basis as a rarity. So that was great. I don't know. I've done some nice recording sessions with different artists as well that are nice, but I think on a concert platform, I think I'll go playing with the orchestra because it's so different to what I usually. The Battle Creek thing that I do all the time, and that is all. Every time I play there, I'm almost pinching myself thinking the same thing. This is so different. But on the spot, I'll go for the symphony orchestra.
Fantastic! It's not every day that a tenor horn gets to perform.
No,
with an orchestra.
I wish it was.
Oh, brilliant. So, I mean, changing topic, I mean, completely again, obviously you are a Bessin clinician tester and you are the main lead in the development of the Bessin Prestige tenor horn, which obviously you play exclusively on. Tenor horn players across the country, the world perform on. Could you tell us a little bit about the process for this, how you started to develop it and change it from the kind of classic sovereign that obviously once upon a time everyone played on.
Yeah, well, they're not too dissimilar, first of all. So I think it'd be wrong to sort of imply that the Prestige and the Sovereign are so different instruments because they're not. The basic components of the instruments are very similar. When I started, I can't think what year it was now. It's not terrible. Whatever year it was I started, maybe 2005-ish. I don't know. I'll look that up. I shouldn't know. Oh, dear. When I started with that in France, Bessin was in France then. I was playing Bessin before. Bessin used to be based in London, and I was a Bessin artist back then. But as most people know, things went wrong, and Bessin got broken up, and I moved to Schwaben-Kahlwith side of it, and the other side of it went to France, and eventually it all came back together.
Yeah.
So I started working in France with the Sovereigns and the Prestige Horn. And they'd asked me, the Prestige Horn was already in existence, but they wanted to revamp it. There was a few technical faults that they'd made with it, so they wanted to rejig all those, basically, with plenty of time. So we decided to go back to the drawing board, really, and back to the Sovereign that was built back in the 70s, a long time ago, using that instrument as a model. And what can we tweak from there to make a Prestige without changing an instrument? Without being too technical about this, you have a difference between a conical and a cylindrical instrument. A trumpet is a cylindrical instrument where the bore shape doesn't change size, whereas a cornet or a tenor horn is conical. That means the bore through the instrument is always getting bigger. Yeah. So the important thing for me was to keep that in place. When you start to change that with an instrument, problems will come. So that instrument, the Sovereign that we all know, has been a beautiful instrument all the way.
I still perform on it.
Absolutely. I've got loads myself. So, and in fact, we took one of mine to the factory, took it all apart, and they had amazing technology that could recreate that and rebuild that. And then we just started doing little tweaks from there and trying something. And if it was an improvement, like moving from stainless steel valves to aluminium valves, things like that, was one of the first things we did. We tried many, many different lead pipes to think the different materials of the bells. The trigger was the very last thing we did, which is important to me, that we didn't build an instrument that had a trigger first. The trigger had to come last, because you shouldn't have an instrument where you think, I have to use the trigger all the time. So it was the same makeup as the Sovereign with little enhancements. That's basically the process we did. Trial and error. We'd try one thing at a time. If it worked, we would keep it. If it didn't work, we scrap it. Rather than trying to build a completely different new instrument, because by doing that you can ruin the conical makeup and characteristics of that Sovereign, which I was currently playing at the time and loved, so I didn't really want to take away from that. So that's basically how we went about it. And things are still the same today. I've not been to Germany at all the last 12 months, obviously. The factory's now in Germany, but when we go over and I test all the Sovereigns and the Prestiges that we're always looking to advance if we can, whatever, we're always checking every little bits and bobs and what we can do with either model and go from there. So there's always regular discussions on how the instrument is, which is very forward thinking, which is great.
Yeah, brilliant. It's great that you can go and even test them all and make sure they're
It's fascinating to learn the ins and outs of instruments. I think is really, really interesting. And partials and things like that. And the conical, if you take your tuning slide and try and put it in backwards, it doesn't fit.
No.
And I didn't really think about that much before. No. Why doesn't it fit? Why is one side bigger than the other?
Yeah.
And I now know it's because it's conical. So a brass band instrument, most brass band instruments, if you compare a cornet to a trumpet, a cornet has a big mouthpiece but a very small lead pipe. Yeah. And the lead pipe is always growing. You take a trumpet, and a small mouthpiece going into a big lead pipe, and that lead pipe, which is the same size as a tenor horn lead pipe, incidentally, is the same size until the flare of the bell.
Yeah.
So when you understand the makeup of the instrument, that gives you a better idea how to progress and make advancements on that.
Then. Yeah, very interesting. To me, I just pick it up and play it, and that's what matters to me.
Well, that's their job in Germany, to make it so you can do that.
It's your job. It's your job to look after all of that stuff. So I've just got a couple more questions. So you've released a few solo CDs, and the latest one, which you released just a couple of years ago, was solely dedicated to the music of Paganini, which is fantastic. You know, it's not music originally written for the tenor horn.
Definitely not.
In the slightest. Not even necessarily suited to the instrument in origin. But where did the inspiration for this come from?
I guess I've always dabbled and looked into older repertoire. As we know, the tenor horn, our repertoire is very, very limited from a very small period. And I've always loved going back to, you know, Baroque, Romantic eras and doing transcriptions and playing things from there. And I'd always had a slight fascination with Paganini. And I remember first hearing about him while studying A-level music, and my A-level music teacher would play the recording, which actually was his first concerto, not the 24th Caprice like you'd think, which we tend to hear most today.
Yeah.
He plays the last movement of his first concerto, and I fell in love with it. And briefly studied a little bit about it, and then during my time as a student at the Royal Northern College, through your history lessons, again, you hear more about things like that, and I learned about Liszt, and how Liszt had been influenced by Paganini. So it was always underlying, and I don't know the exact moment it happened, but I just thought I should have a go at see if some of this would work. And when I looked up Paganini, one of the first interesting things was that he was playing an E flat, not in D. So he would tune his violin a semitone higher.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, E flat sprung to mind. Thought, yeah. Oh, hang on a minute, that might be possible. So I just started trying to source PDFs of his music, which wasn't easy actually from here and everywhere, and just started listening to his music, reading the music through as I was listening to it, and from there it just developed and started. I thought, I wonder if I can get a full CD of this together, and I did. That was
a challenge.
A huge it was a big project, but I loved it, and listened to all the music along the way, and listening to other great soloists playing his music, which is a great project, and studying the man himself. He had such an incredible career.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something I love doing. And still today, if I give a Paganini recital, it's great to talk about Paganini, his music, his life, his times, and then play some of his music. I love it. It's great.
Amazing. I mean, I'm sure everyone's familiar with the test piece, which is Paganini Variations, but other than that, I don't...
So that came from his 24th Caprice, and that is an incredible piece of music, isn't it? By Wilby. And Rachmaninoff and Liszt and Brahms, other composers, had also taken, the South Bank Show even, taken that 24th Caprice and used that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Rachmaninoff's is probably the most famous of them all, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But yeah, brilliant music.
Yeah, fantastic. And finally, my final question for you really is that I've tried not to bring COVID into it too much here and there, because we're all sick to death of talking about it.
Absolutely.
But what are you looking forward to now that the world and life is starting to get back to normal?
Well, the world is going to need to celebrate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not all at the same time, as we can see with the tragedy over in India and stuff. But certainly in the UK, we're seeing light at the end of the tunnel. And I know lots of musicians have been hit hard, and we're very worried about the future. We all are. But the world is going to want to celebrate, and what better way to celebrate than through music?
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that the concerts will be flourishing. The competitions will be more attended than ever before, because we've been deprived of it. And it's one thing we've all learned during COVID, is how lucky we are to have music, how lucky we are to share music with friends and family, to go to a band rehearsal, and socially interact through music with everybody. We appreciate that and realise that more now than we've ever done before. Mm. And so when we come out of this and go back into it, we'll appreciate music even more and love the concerts even more. So it's an experience we will never want to have again. I know that, but there is good things to follow, surely.
Yeah, it's something I'm looking forward to getting back to. Obviously,
I've had a student this morning that's got his first band rehearsal tonight. Who can't wait and. Slowly but surely, things are starting to piece together, and things are happening. And we can't wait for it. I'm due to go back to America. I should be in Las Vegas today.
Oh. Instead, you're here recording a podcast with me.
we can look at the doom and gloom of things that have been cancelled, but hopefully they will all come back together.
Yeah,
and then some as the future maps out in a better way.
Yeah. Fantastic. And at this point, I say once again, thank you for being
nice
a part of this podcast and taking the time to do this, especially as you said, you should be in Las Vegas, and it's also on your birthday. So
it's my birthday treat.
Your cup of tea.
And you got me a nice cup of tea. Thank you very much.
And finally, just to draw this episode to a close, to everyone listening, thank you once again for tuning in to another episode of the Brass Cast. You know the drill by now. If you've listened to this podcast before, make sure you're following the Brass Cast on Facebook and Instagram, and make sure you're caught up with all of our previous episodes on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts. And I'm sure if you listen to them all, there's bits that Owen's talked about that will, you know, be mentioned in other ones. So, you know, make sure you go and listen to them, because they all link in some way or another. Our community is very small. But that is all for now. Thank you again, Owen. And that's it for now. Bye-bye for now.